From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 43 for Friday, the 16th of September, 2011. On the show this week, nuclear power hasn't ever had an easy ride in the public eye, and in the wake of Japan's Fukushima disaster, it has only been under closer scrutiny. But there could be a safer alternative. In the second half of our show this week, we'll find out what it is, how it works, and how the UK could benefit from it. But before we dive into a deep, exciting sea of nuclear physics, it's time for a gentle cleansing shower under a waterfall of Wired news. Oh hi, I'm Nate Langston, and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me next to Condé Nast Reactor number 6, news editor Duncan Gear. Thanks for that, Duncan. And also, of course, associate editor Olivia _ Solon. Now, I should explain that we've been asked to record some sounds in our studio for the Wired iPad app. And unfortunately, that does mean Duncan and Liv have been sat playing with it for the last 10 minutes.
That's great.
It is, yeah. It's not even remotely annoying. So anyway, before I bust a gut, we're going to move into some news. Seriously, that thing is not fun.
It is fun.
It's really not. We're going to move into some news. And later on, yes, we've got a very large and not at all dull feature about nuclear physics. I know nuclear physics isn't necessarily the most exciting topic in the world, but it is today.
Not as exciting as a sound machine.
That's debatable. Let's talk about Windows 8, which was shown off this week at Microsoft's Build conference and given out to 500,000 developers. I'll say given out. It was downloaded 500,000 times by developers overnight. And I put in our little lineup notes here, possibly the biggest UI shift in the history of Windows.
It's all panel-y.
Basically, what Windows 8, which we're expecting to be out next year, is basically a operating system that's designed as much for desktop PCs and laptops as it is for tablet computers, really to compete with the iPad and Android. And the way that Microsoft has achieved this is by saying, that start menu, yeah, we don't need that anymore. Let's have a giant grid of applications, exactly like we have on Windows Phone, and what could be on a Windows Phone tablet, should they exist in the future. And kind of just merge the whole experience into one operating system that works just as well on desktops as tablets. It's caused a bit of a shake, actually, in the blogosphere overnight.
To me, it sounds a little horrific, to tell you the truth. I'm not entirely convinced by the idea.
Well, there are some other things that are going to be a part of Windows 8 that could excite you a little more. Xbox Live, for example, actually coming to Windows. Yeah. That's got to be a good move, surely.
Well, games have been doing quite well on Windows on their own for quite some time. Without any support from Microsoft. And
what are you on about? Games, Xbox is a huge platform.
Yeah, Xbox is good and everything, but I'm quite happy for Xbox to continue doing its own little thing. And the things that make Xbox work so well aren't the things that make PC games work so well.
Okay, but at the end of the day, it does mean that you can have one unified gaming platform that brings PC gamers and console gamers at least together in a way that could benefit people like me who don't have a PC.
But isn't it like bringing together 14-year-old girls and boys at a party? They'll be in the same room, but they'll stand opposite each other, looking, giving each other disapproving looks.
Yes, but listen, if you don't have those experiences when you're a teenager, then you grow up to be some kind of vagrant. It's an important learning experience for the future of boys and girls, and in this case, Microsoft.
We're slightly off topic here.
We are. But the other thing that's notable about Windows 8 is the fact that it can run on ARM and x86 architectures. And to put that into plain English, that means that it can run on the type of processors that we find in tablets, as well as the type of processors from people like Intel on desktop PCs. And because the interface is designed to kind of be, it can adapt itself to whatever kind of display it's on, whether that's a PC screen with a keyboard or a tablet that's just a touchscreen. It means that it's an potentially incredibly flexible operating system. So it's pretty big news, and it could only be a year or so before it actually gets released. So can
we have a play with it yet? Is it available to download?
Sort of. I imagine it's available from illicit sources on the net, but officially it's only available to Microsoft developers. So I think people with a TechNet subscription can download it. But I imagine if you ask hard enough or Google enough or Bing enough, then you'll probably find a copy. So interesting stuff. And getting rid of the start menu. No more start menu. That's been there for so long.
Since Windows 95.
Anyway, let's leave Windows. Let's talk about the Soyuz. Over the last few weeks, we've talked a lot about how the International Space Station is potentially facing abandonment as a result of NASA retiring the space shuttles and the Russians crashing their replacements to the space shuttles. Duncan, some exciting news.
Yeah, they've managed to work out exactly what went wrong with the unmanned Soyuz craft that crashed earlier in this year. And they've announced a series of dates for the next run of trips to the International Space Station. And that means that Soyuz ships are going to be ferrying some new supplies, food, science instruments, that kind of thing, up on the 30th of October. And then there'll be another follow-up flight on 26th January of next year. And the crucial thing that this means is that the space station won't be evacuated. There will be humankind's continuing inhabitation of space will continue.
This does mean, of course, that Liv's plan to inhabit the ISS temporarily with giant hordes of dogs isn't going to happen.
No, but noticing that it's just before Halloween, I think there should be a themed batch of items going up there.
Oh, like ghost costumes?
Yeah, for example.
I'll let you make that phone call.
Bobbing apples.
We found out what caused the crash, though, didn't we, of the Soyuz rocket the other week?
We did. It was a faulty fuel duct, which was a kind of manufacturing glitch, but they've worked that out and they've checked all the other Soyuz craft for it, and they seem confident that they'll be able to avoid that problem in the future.
Well, it's great news that trips to the ISS can continue, but that's not the only other bit of space news that occurred this week. We also found out that the James Webb Telescope, which is kind of the official replacement for Hubble and with a much, much higher resolution than Hubble has, is not going to be scrapped as a plan, right? They're going to continue to launch it.
Yeah, Hubble has been around for a long, long time now. It was launched in 1990 and it's planned to be decommissioned in 2014. And so they're looking into replacing it. And the replacement is the James Webb Space Telescope, which was under budgetary threat earlier in the year. It looked like it was going to be cancelled. But happily, the United States Congress has approved enough cash for it to continue funding for its 2018 launch.
Which is great news because primarily at the moment, Hubble has, I think, what is this, about a 7-foot mirror, which is, I mean, everyone's seen the kind of pictures Hubble can gather. But the James Webb Telescope in total, it has a working resolution of basically a 21-foot mirror, which
it's a big ass mirror.
Is just absolutely enormous. And the James Webb Telescope will be looking at some of the earliest objects in the galaxy, in the universe. So this is great news that it's going to continue.
It's very, very good news. It's not 100% total certain. It needs to go before the full appropriations committee and then go to the Senate floor for a vote. And of course, the Senate floor is not a calm place at the moment when it comes to approving, you know, big budgetary spending. But it's looking good for the time being. We'll keep you posted.
Liv, are you excited about deep space photography?
I am, actually. Really excited. I'm not sure why they changed their mind.
The subcommittee chairwoman, Barbara Mikulski, said, "In a spending bill that has less to spend, we naturally focus on the cuts and the things we can't do. But we also want to focus on the things that we can do." And she said the bill invests more than $12 billion in scientific research and R&D development. And so it's all about kind of creating new products and new jobs for the future. And they're hoping that this is going to do exactly that.
Well, from space to database, Liv, you wrote a interesting piece this week about something called diagnosia, which could overhaul the ability for doctors to quickly compare drugs.
Yeah, across 22 different markets. I mean, currently, there's no centralized database of all the information about different drugs across different countries in Europe.
So medical drugs.
Medical drugs. I mean, yeah, not yeah. Medical drugs. There are things that exist in the US, like drugs.com. But in Europe, currently, if a doctor wants to check out a particular prescription and find out what the name of that drug is in Poland as opposed to what it is in Norway, there's no simple way of doing this. And there's no single database for all of these different names, for all these different variants and what they're called and how they're prescribed in different markets. So it seems pretty simple. It seems like an obvious thing that you should already exist, but it doesn't. So this team behind a company called Diagnosia has found a way to aggregate all of this information that is currently largely stored in PDF documents, so not very user-friendly, and they're all very different formats. So, you know, the leaflet that you might get with Viagra in the UK might be one page long and with all the indications listed above the side effects or something. And then in Norway, it might be 10 pages, and ordered in a different way. So they found a way of scraping all this information and putting it into an XML file so that it's quickly comparable and searchable, I guess.
And I'm assuming that by putting it into some kind of an XML file, which basically just strips everything down to its raw data, and then it can be used in other applications via APIs, and developers can build programs.
The idea is to create an API. They haven't done this yet, but they want to create it so people could then build apps off it. And they also want to link it to things like research that's linked to those drugs. So a doctor would be able to search for the drugs and then find related links to studies and then maybe sections of pharmacology books. So it's just a really nice, interesting kind of open data project.
And will it be freely available, or will developers have to pay for access?
For patients, it'll be freely available. For doctors, it's freely available, but there's going to be a freemium model there, so they'll have to pay to access things like the studies and ancillary information.
So a little bit like you can borrow a library book, but you can't necessarily access all the medical journals.
Exactly. So they're looking to do deals with the medical journal publishers. But I don't know about the API at this stage. They haven't been clear about that, but I'm sure they're pretty free about
This could be great for students, actually, if this could be made into some kind of a tablet application. I mean, we've always known that
pun intended, I hope.
But thank you. One of the big attractions to ebooks and tablets, of course, is that you can take these giant tomes of medical information and just huge quantities of information, and you can carry it all around.
Yeah.
Have this in a tablet app that a university maybe could pay for on your behalf as part of your tuition.
Yeah.
This could give you a great one-click access to all this kind of information for up-and-coming doctors.
Well, doctors and patients, I guess. If you're stuck for a prescription in Lithuania, you can very quickly find out what name your drug goes under there.
I think with these, one of the inherent problems can be that, you know, it requires some kind of data entry or character recognition, stuff like that. So I think really we need to have some kind of guarantee that the data is being properly formatted and not ending up in the wrong cell and actually causing someone to have Viagra when they actually thought they just needed flu treatment.
No, I think the main,
which is always embarrassing.
The main thing they're trying to avoid is that a lot of people's information about drugs, when a consumer does a search, is they'll look online, they'll find some kind of dodgy self-help blog where someone's, you know, proclaiming the virtues of a particular drug, and because there isn't a central repository, there's no kind of trusted source. And you know, it's not drugs aren't really a kind of TripAdvisor situation.
Do we know when this might hit the market? Still in research.
They're launching some of the German speaking markets because the team behind it are German. But it's going to be rolling out. I think they're getting 8 countries by the end of 2011, and they want to roll out to 22.
That's brilliant. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the Grindr for professional networking.
Registration for the Wired 2011 Summit is now open. Don't miss your chance to hear some of the most inspiring talks from thought leaders of the Wired world over 2 days this October in London. For more information, please visit wiredevent.co.uk.
Liv, for people who aren't aware, give me a brief recap of what the Grindr application is. The mobile app Grindr.
Grindr helps you to find hookups for sexual liaisons in the vicinity of where you are. So it was originally for gay and lesbians to find other like-minded people in their area based on how close they are as opposed to, you know, what their interests might be. And it's now opened up to, it's now for heterosexual people as well.
To find local, as in across the road from you, hookups.
Yeah, as in you'll be able to, you can see on a map who on that dating site is within the nearest 500 metres, mile, 2 miles, 3 miles. Yeah.
And now the thinking behind that has come to the world of professional networking.
Well, exactly. I mean, I quite often go to big conferences, and the only way of finding out who's there, or unless you've pre-arranged, is by maybe looking on the Twitter hashtag or something, and you can check who you know who's there, and you can might be able to find them. But this app called Sonar, it searches through your Twitter, Facebook, Foursquare, and LinkedIn friends in a room, and lets you work out who else is there with you, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and I guess this is because you might want to meet some person you followed for 2 years and they just happen to be at a conference.
Exactly.
And you really want to go
and they might
and
have a cat
them.
As their face on their Twitter profile, for example, or LinkedIn. It's quite often the very senior people who might not be on Twitter or on any of the other these other or your Facebook friends, but they'll be on LinkedIn and you haven't, you maybe spoken to them once, but you don't quite know how to approach them, and this app kind of helps facilitate that. You can double check their image, you can message them, and you can arrange to meet up, not to have sex with them, presumably.
Surely though, this relies on them telling the app that they're at the conference in the first place?
Well, they don't have to tell Sonar, so they don't have to subscribe to or have downloaded Sonar. But what the major sticking point at the moment is the fact that it relies on the check-in status of Foursquare and Facebook Places. And I think only 17% of people with mobile phones actually use these services. So it's severely limiting. But the idea, I think, is interesting, the fact that it will cross-reference all of these networks. So if they've checked in on Facebook, you might be able to find their, you know, their LinkedIn profile kind of thing.
I think it's a really good idea. I would use this. I mean, we go to quite a lot of conferences and a lot of trade shows and things like that. And quite often you have a lot of people you follow on Twitter and who may follow you, but you don't actually know them. You're just kind of professionally connected. This seems like a really good way of, you know, of breaking the ice and just being able to say, oh, I see you're nearby. Do you want to grab a coffee? Maybe even over Twitter, just because you know that they're close.
Yeah, because Duncan and I were talking about this earlier. One of the really annoying things about the hashtag event hashtags is that there's no easy way to find the people you know who are in that conversation. And this is a really good way of creating that.
I guess the downside of this is it might disincline some people from using Foursquare and Facebook to check into these conferences, because they don't want to suddenly be hassled by loads of people saying, oh, you're at this place. Oh, let's meet up. Let's have a coffee.
Oh, God. I would love, sometimes, don't you hate it when you're on an event on your own and you want to talk to people?
No.
No.
Never. I have my headphones in, and if anyone interrupts me, I slap them.
Oh, no. I'm constantly trying to find people to talk to, so, you know.
Well, I think it's only going to be a matter of time before Grindr and Sonar team up and we have some kind of professional networking hookup service for businessmen.
Yeah.
Which would be, and businesswomen, of course, which would be... I wouldn't use it. My girlfriend wouldn't be impressed. Anyway, let's move swiftly on. And the PlayStation Vita, which is the new PlayStation Portable, which we talked about back in March when it was first properly announced, we found out that it's going to be coming out in Japan in December. But unfortunately, the United Kingdom, the best market, thank you, isn't going to be getting it until next year. This makes me a sad panda.
Yeah, because we were quite excited about this earlier in the year when it was originally announced, weren't we?
We were, and I was made more excited about it this week because I found out that Final Fantasy X, one of the greatest video games ever made in the whole history of humanity, is going to be kind of upscaled or upgraphicked for the Vita, which means Final Fantasy X on a handheld. This is the dream. We are living in the future.
See, for me, that isn't the most exciting thing. The most exciting thing is the price. It's only going to cost about £230 or so.
Yeah, this thing's tricked out to hell, actually. The device is quad-core. It's got a 3G chip if you want one. It's got two cameras, a giant OLED touchscreen, and it's got this kind of multi-touch finger stretching thing on pad on the back, so you can use multi-touch while holding it, and analog joypads. It's just... I can't wait. I'm so excited. Can you tell?
I can tell, yeah.
Can tell.
Before we get to our feature, though, there's one other thing that I want to get excited about, because it reminds me of when we talked about BioArt a few months ago. And this is a Chicago artist called Joshua Harker, who has launched a project to fund a 3D printed human skull. Liv.
Yes.
This is one of yours.
That's correct. It's a Kickstarter project. And he the idea was that he wanted to go straight to the people who would buy his art rather than having an intermediary, you know, a gallery. Well, maybe he couldn't get a gallery.
Well, just for background, Kickstarter lets lots of people chip in and fund a project.
Crowd-funded project, yes. So he suggested that he's got this amazing thing that he wants to sell and people can bid for it. And depending on how much they bid, they can get different sizes of the skull or things like postcards if they only bid a small amount, or a mega, you know, ornate coloured different whatever choice they want skull at the higher end.
And these prints are, I mean, they're amazing. We've got some photos on the website, actually, on wired.co.uk, and they're amazing pictures. I mean, they just look gorgeous. I would happily fund one of these.
Yeah, it's based on his previous work called Tangles. So it's all these really strange tangled knotted drawings that he used to make but could never make physically because there was just no way of manufacturing them in the past. But obviously with the arrival of 3D printing, it's made it possible to create formerly impossible to manufacture shapes.
And these are these 100% designed, or are they kind of generated from existing scans of skulls, or how does it work?
He has designed them in CAD software based on, you know, real skulls, but then he's just made these ridiculously intricate kind of cutout patterns all over them. It looks incredibly fragile, but apparently it's, you know, fairly sturdy, made out of some kind of polyamide. But yeah, and I really want to get one. I think $50 you can get the small one.
Well, if you go to wired.co.uk and search Kickstarter skull, you can find a little gallery of some images of this skull.
And contribute if you want to.
And even contribute. And it reminds me a little bit, actually, of when we were talking about BioArt, there was a 3D printed brain scan that you wrote about. And I actually went to see the work that you wrote about in a gallery. It was somewhere near Baker Street in London. And it's amazing to see this kind of, you know, medical imaging being turned into an actual tangible physical object. It's kind of mind-blowing, not literally, but kind of, sort of, in person.
Well, it was.
That's the second unintentional pun of the podcast.
I'm just on a roll.
But it was slightly, didn't that particular brain scan have an aneurysm? So it was a kind of mind-blowing.
Not that one. No, there were two. There was one of them had actually had a benign tumour.
Oh, that was it.
And it was kind of, that was
all
a laser.
The blood vessels.
It was a laser-etched cube. And that was at the same gallery. And it was, it's amazing to see. So I'm all in favour for more of these existing. Well, that's going to do it for our news for this week. And it's time to venture into the world of nuclear physics for our feature.
The Fukushima nuclear plant disaster has resulted in a polarisation of attitudes towards nuclear power in Europe. Germany and Switzerland have both announced the intention to phase out nuclear power plants, while France, in contrast, has announced a €1 billion investment in atomic power. But on this side of the channel, Scotland has signed up to a non-nuclear future, while the British government is to drive ahead with plans to build yet more reactors. But at this year's British Science Festival, which took place this week, details of an alternate nuclear technology, one that can produce safe, sustainable and carbon-free electricity, was presented. We talked to Professor Bob Kavinsky, Dean of Applied Sciences at the University of Huddersfield, to get all of the details. Well, thank you, Bob, for joining us for this week's wired.co.uk podcast.
Hello.
In the talk that you gave for the British Science Festival, you said it's increasingly apparent that any strategy which attempts to avert further man-made damage to the climate, whilst also satisfying global demands for energy, must include low-carbon nuclear power at its core. But what are the issues that need to be addressed before nuclear power is used more widely?
The issues that need to be addressed, I think, are almost issues associated with perception of nuclear power rather than nuclear power itself. I think from the very early days of nuclear power, it's been associated with the military and that linking of nuclear reactors with nuclear bombs, which is really not a proper link at all, but it's linked in the public's mind, has made people very wary, and particularly wary about the issues of waste, of radiation and proliferation.
And obviously the Fukushima disaster has said something to do with public perception at the moment.
It's certainly brought it into sharp relief, and I think that the media in particular have concentrated overly on Fukushima when there was a real human disaster taking place in Japan that was far wider and far more devastating.
But also we need to mention the fact that Germany has now decided to end its nuclear power program. But I mention that in light of a popular survey which was talked about at the Science Festival, which basically suggested that the UK, there is actually growing support for nuclear power. Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Well, I think there has been an increasing awareness of the need for nuclear power in the UK for quite a long time now. I think the thing that's particularly surprising is that post-Fukushima, that support hasn't waned in any way, despite all of the bad publicity. And certainly you mentioned the reaction of Germany, also Italy and Switzerland are possibly going down the same route. But that sort of revulsion towards nuclear power hasn't taken place in the UK. And there's barely been a blip in the public support throughout Fukushima. And I think that one of the reasons for this is that the British are probably slightly more pragmatic and they're really worried about the energy security. They're worried about the cost of getting electricity into their house. And they realise that nuclear is possibly the best way of doing that.
Coming back to the survey, it actually found that 41% of respondents agreed that the benefits of nuclear power outweighed the risks. But what we wanted to talk to you about is actually an even safer nuclear alternative. Can you tell us more?
I can. What I mentioned was that in the early days of nuclear power, civil nuclear power generation was linked to the military. And this link meant that a real opportunity was lost in the very early days of the development of nuclear energy. And in fact, it was a visionary called Alvin Weinberg who worked on the Manhattan Project developing the bomb, but also worked on nuclear energy. And he realized there was a safer way of delivering nuclear power. And that was not to go down the uranium-plutonium route, which was the route that the military wanted to go down, but instead of using uranium as a source material, to use thorium instead. And thorium has some tremendous advantages over uranium, and particularly over plutonium. For a start, its energy density is very, very much greater. 1 ton of thorium is equivalent to about 200 tons of uranium. But the other advantages are that it produces far less waste than uranium or plutonium. And in fact, it doesn't produce plutonium, so it can't be used to make bombs and proliferate. Another advantage is that you can mix the legacy waste from existing reactors in with the thorium and burn that to render it much safer.
Now, as chairman of the Thorium Energy Amplifier Association, is your job now basically to try and get thorium in widespread use again? And if that's the case, what exactly is it that your association needs to do to make this happen?
Okay, well, to take one step back, I'm not actually a nuclear physicist at all. I'm a condensed matter physicist looking at the properties of material, but I use reactors and spallation neutron sources to do that. And so I've come to thorium pretty much as an outsider because it seems to make so much sense. There are several ways that you can use thorium. You could use it by mixing it with plutonium or uranium and putting it in a conventional reactor. And this is what the Indians are trying to do at the moment because they've got vast thorium reserves and they're wanting to use the thorium to provide their electricity. Or you could use a development that Weinberg himself was involved with back in the 1960s called a molten salt reactor. And there are a lot of strong advocates suggesting that the molten salt reactor may be the best way of utilizing thorium. Well, our approach is a slightly different one. And I think all of these approaches are compatible and they all get thorium onto the agenda. Our approach is to use a process called spallation. And we're very good at spallation in the UK. We built one of the world's most powerful spallation neutron sources at ISIS at the Rutherford Laboratory. And spallation is the process where you take a particle beam, you impact a heavy metal target, and you spall, or you chip out, neutrons. Now, our idea, which is not a new one, it was originally thought of by Carlo Rubbia back in the 90s, is to take a reactor core and embed within it a spallation target. So you can make the reactor subcritical. In other words, it won't run because there aren't sufficient neutrons to run it. But then you take the particle beam into the accelerator, into the reactor, you spall out the neutrons, and that causes the fission to take place. That generates the heat, which generates the electricity. You take some of that electricity and put it back into the accelerator, and then that powers the reactor. So if you want to switch off the reactor, you flick a switch, as you would with a light bulb. Because the only way the reactor can run is because the neutrons are being produced by the spallation process.
And so the facilities to do this are already built and up and running in the UK?
Well, we know how to do the spallation part of it. We know how to build the core of a reactor. What we now need to do is to look at the engineering of putting those two things together. But what it will give you is a much safer reactor because it is essentially subcritical. It will never go critical on its own and therefore never run away with itself. So we have one vision for using thorium. It's not incompatible with the lithium fluoride reactors, and it's not incompatible with the conventional reactors. But what it is saying is that we've essentially on the planet got 10,000 years worth of thorium to provide our electricity. Why not make use of it? And why not diversify the energy economy so we're not reliant on one single technology or one single source of energy?
And you've said that this could be deployed as early as 2025 and could also be an alternative to the GEM 4 nuclear systems.
That's right. That's what I firmly believe, yes. And in fact, one company, what's called Arca Solutions, they've just been taken over by Jacobs Engineering, have proposed building one of these accelerator-driven subcritical reactors. They call it the ADTR. And I think that they're looking for a wider commercial interest to invest in that technology and move it forward. And of course, the other great advantage is that this is new technology. It's new technology based on accelerators, and the UK is very good at accelerators, and we could see it actually generating a multi-billion pound UK export industry in a novel form of nuclear energy.
You mentioned that. You talked about how the benefits of developing this technology would go far beyond power production. Could you talk to us a bit more about that?
Yes, of course. I think that one thing that people are not really aware of is that there are something like 15,000 particle accelerators in the world at the moment, and probably only about 100 of them do the sort of physics that you hear about on the news, like the Large Hadron Collider. There is a growing use of accelerators in medical facilities. it's an ideal way of treating tumors, that a particle beam, you either using protons or carbon ions, is a very much better way of burning out a cancer than, for example, gamma ray radiation treatment, which is what we use predominantly at the moment. But the problem is that if you go to more powerful accelerators, almost every one you build is a prototype. There is no production line that produces good, high-quality, reliable accelerators over and over again. Well, if we were to generate a nuclear industry like this, we would be developing that technology, the technology for delivering those sort of accelerators. And those accelerators could be used in everything from radiopharmaceutical production to energy production that we've just talked about, or radiation treatment.
So there's a mass of possibilities, but moving back from the future, as it were, what's actually happening now?
Well, what's happening at the moment is on the accelerator side, we've just had some major successes in a program called CONFORM, which has been run by a colleague of mine at Huddersfield University, Professor Roger Barlow. And we've worked on that project for about 4 years with a wide collaboration, international collaboration. And for the first time earlier this year, we showed that an entirely new method of accelerating particles actually works. We built EMMA, as we call her, is a model non-scaling fixed field alternating gradient accelerator, which trips off the tongue. but it uses a new type of acceleration and it seems to work. And so what we're now looking at doing is scaling up EMMA for these sort of practical purposes. It's a much simpler machine, and therefore, in principle, it should be easier to run and more reliable, and it's much smaller, therefore it should also be much cheaper. So we're developing the accelerator side of things. On the thorium side, we're looking with colleagues at Cambridge at reactor designs and how we could move the ADSR principle forward. But on a much wider international scale, there is a growing support for the use of thorium as a nuclear fuel. There's also growing resistance, because what we have to remember is the whole industry has been developed around uranium and plutonium. And the people who are in that industry naturally don't want people coming in from left of field saying, hang on, we've got a better way of doing it. But I think that the point is being missed, in that uranium is not going to last forever. And thorium and uranium processing could sit side by side. So there is this growing support for thorium as a fuel. And perhaps the best coordination effort that's been put into developing a thorium lobby in the UK was the launch of the Weinberg Foundation, named after Alvin Weinberg, who promoted thorium back in the 60s, in the House of Lords by Baroness Bryony Worthington last Thursday. And that may be a focus of scientists, engineers, politicians, even Friends of the Earth, who see this as a way forward, not just for nuclear energy, but for also making an impact on the climate change problem.
So exciting things could happen over the next couple of years.
I think so, yes.
Well, that was everything I was going to ask you about, Bob. Thank you ever so much for your time. And if people want more information about the association, where should they go?
It's just www.thoria.org.
That was Bob Kavinsky from the University of Huddersfield and chairman of the Thorium Energy Amplifier Association. For more details about thorium and the association's vision of an alternate nuclear future, check out our feature on wired.co.uk.
Actually, you probably shouldn't do that after nuclear power feature, should we?
No, but instead I'll say thank you, Katie, and I now know 6,000 times more about thorium. It's a hell of a thory. Sorry.
Oh, dear.
Before we go any deeper down this pit of disaster, Liv, tell people how they can get in touch with us, should they want to.
Should they want to, they can follow us on Twitter. The whole team is on @WiredUK. If you just want to follow Nate, he's on @NateLangson. Duncan is @DuncanGear. And I am Olivia_Solon.
And Katie is on
That is terrible. Katie is on @KatieScott1980.
And we've got a email address which you can send us electronic post to. Duncan, tell people how they use that type of stamp.
You open your email software or web page or whatever it is you like to do with your email and type in podcast@wired.co.uk and a good message, and maybe attach a picture of a cat or something like that, and then hit send.
That's always going to get it read. We've also got a Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/wiredUK, hit the like button and ask us some questions. It's actually a really good place to start asking us questions that we can answer maybe on the podcast. If you have a question, go in there and just go and answer one. I mean, answer someone else's and you can ask your own. You know where I'm going with this. And I think until next time, stay excellent to each other.
Is that like a whippet crossed with a miniature schnauzer?
Oh,
a snippet.
You should totes invent that.
The full schnauzer.